You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to U.S. Representative Mike Gallagher as part of our series of candidate interviews. He's the Republican incumbent running for re-election in Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. First, there's an overlooked challenge facing schools in Milwaukee: student turnover. A large number of kids switch from one school to another from year to year or even during a school year. That can cause problems for the kids and the learning environment. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter Aaron Richards is looking at the issue in an ongoing investigative report. Aaron, great to have you back with us.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Also with us is Clara Doctor, a K-4 teacher at Stella Collegiate Charter School. Clara, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
Aaron, you start this article. It's first in a series looking at the Carver Academy in Milwaukee. Tell us about that school and what turnover it has done there.
Carver Academy is a, a high-need school on the north side of Milwaukee, a K-8 school, pretty big building. It's gotten a lot of attention over the last 5 years to have a bunch of efforts aimed at trying to lift achievement in the school, and it's really struggled to have those reforms stick because of almost 40% student turnover from year to year. And nobody really realized how big of an impediment that would be to changing the academic climate at Carver until the principal, former principal actually, realized that year to year she wasn't even able to recognize her own students. So while they had success in improving the behavioral climate at Carver and implementing things like assemblies and a culture where kids wanted to come to school, they really had a hard time moving the needle on test scores because every year they were starting over with a new crop of kids and having to set new expectations for families who hadn't been with the school year over year.
And Aaron, how does Milwaukee compare to the rest of the state when it comes to the rate of school turnover, kids going from one school to another?
Our analysis found about 1 in 10 kids in the state of Wisconsin switch schools, either during the year or over the summer. In Milwaukee, that's much higher. Across all the publicly funded schools in Milwaukee, it's about 1 in 4 kids that are changing schools from year to year.
1 in 4.
And of course that varies from school to school. So some of your higher achieving, more stable schools in the district have very low turnover. And then you have a place like North Division High School, which has struggled as one of the lowest performing high schools in the state, and they see half of their students turn over from year to year.
Clara, you are a teacher at a Stella Collegiate Charter School. How does this work out in your classroom? What kind of turnover do you see there?
Yeah, so at Stellar, I teach in a K-4 classroom, and last year we had 26 students in our classroom, and we had 5 students who entered after the official start date, and we had 10 who exited throughout the year. So we had 5 who left in September last year, and then the rest of the 5 were scattered throughout the year. This year already, we've had 5 students who have left, and we've had 5 students who have entered into our K-4 classroom.
That's during the school year.
Yes. So, for example, this year, the 5 who have already come, we had a new student join this Monday. We had a new student 2 weeks ago. And then we had 3 students who started right after Labor Day.
So those are the numbers, Clara. How does that affect the classroom experience for you and, of course, for your students?
Well, I think most importantly for the students, thinking about them and how secure and safe they feel in a classroom setting, especially because they are 4 when they enter K-4. And so there's a lot of transition associated with going to school for the first time, let alone changing schools within your first year of education. And so as a teacher, our priority lies with the students and creating strong relationships with them right on. We do academic interventions with them, and we partner with the families to make sure that they feel welcomed in our community and that we're meeting any needs that they might have to hopefully prevent them from switching out of the school later on.
Aaron, what do we know about how switching schools, either during or between the school year, switching schools over an academic career affects kids' outcomes?
This is a really hard issue to study because we know that kids who switch schools the most are often the kids who are impoverished, and we already know that there's a strong link between poverty and lower test scores. So the challenge is trying to find studies that try to control for the poverty of students and their racial demographics and try to actually isolate the impact of the switch itself on test scores. So to do this project, we partnered with Mike Ford, who's a professor at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, and he looked specifically at students who switched schools between Milwaukee public schools and the private voucher schools. And whether kids went from MPS to a voucher school or from a voucher school to MPS, their test scores were lower in the year after the switch. We only have 1 year of data on that. That's because voucher schools are pretty new to the state information system. But we do know that in that 1 year, we could see a significant drop in achievement. It could be that those kids catch up over time, but coupled with other research that we've seen about how school switching often goes hand in hand with increased behavioral problems and certainly an increased risk of dropping out when kids switch schools at the high school level, we know that this is an issue, and we know that, you know, we need to be talking about how to help families stay with schools, especially if they're working for them over time.
Clara, we talked about what happens in your classroom. I imagine there are similar stories in other classes in your school. Is there a school-wide effort to help kids, whether it's they're changing schools in the summer or, as you were talking about, during the school year?
Yeah, so across our school, we have a dean who works with families, and her role is really to make sure that families are feeling set up once they come to Stellar. And all of the teachers at Stellar really are invested in making sure that when a new student comes in, you know, how are they making friends? How are we catching up with their academics, excuse me? And, you know, what are we providing the families with that maybe another school didn't? And does a family need to be connected to another social resource that perhaps maybe they weren't being connected to before? So I would say in every classroom, all teachers across the state are thinking about, you know, how do we make sure our students are feeling safe and secure and empowered within the classroom?
And Aaron, you talk about not just within the school year, but sometimes you gave an example of one student who was new this year. Her teacher had learned to work with her, meet her needs, and then was able to kind of hand off to the next year teacher and say, hey, this student, if you talk to her about this and so on, it's going to help her make a better school year. If kids move from school to school, you lose that institutional memory of a kid.
It's so basic, but this is so much about relationships between teachers and families and teachers and students. And when I've explained this kind of reporting that I'm doing to a lot of parents in more stable suburban schools, a couple of them have said, you know, I just kind of took it for granted that the school's going to work with my kid for the next 5 or 6 years, or especially if you have a child with a disability. It's easy to take for granted the fact that this school is going to surround your kid and provide them with services as they progress. In a lot of city schools, for a lot of families or families in high poverty areas, that's just not the norm. And it makes it really hard for teachers to hand off that child to their colleague and say, hey, like, these are the three things that you should really think about. And she's really great and loves this kind of incentive. You lose that connectivity. And unfortunately, it's happening the most at schools that desperately are, you know, trying really hard to help kids succeed, and when they can't continue those relationships year after year, it's unfortunately making it even harder for the lowest performing schools with high turnover to get ahead.
We'll pick up the conversation as you continue this series. You'll be joining us again next week. Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
And Clara, thanks for sharing your classroom experience with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Clara Doctor is a K-4 teacher at Stellar Collegiate Charter School, a new Milwaukee school in its third year. And Aaron Richards is an education reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The first article in her series on school turnover is linked at WPR.org. She will be with us this time next week for more on that story. Between now and the November 6th general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for statewide office and for congressional seats to join us for interviews here on Central Time and on The Morning Show. You'll be able to find all of those interviews on wisconsinvote.org. Today we talked to Mike Gallagher. He's running as the Republican incumbent for Wisconsin's 8th congressional district seat, which includes Green Bay. Representative Gallagher, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, first of all, what do you see as the most important issue facing Congress from the perspective of your constituents in the 8th congressional district?
Well, you know, honestly, the question I hear the most from people, and it really is both sides of the aisle and people in between, it's something to the effect of, you know, why can't you guys just work together and get stuff done in Congress? And I think the fact that Congress has a 12% approval rating suggests that the biggest issue, the one that affects all the other policy issues, is the dysfunction itself. It's the way in which the institution has become a shell of its former self, has surrendered a lot of its constitutional power to the executive branch, and isn't doing its job. That's why I founded the Reformers Caucus. That's why I joined the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is equal parts Democrats and Republicans. And it's why I believe, regardless of who wins in November, we then have a critical discussion about how do we get Congress working again. And it's why I work so much on congressional reform issues. And incidentally, that's stuff that, you know, even, you know, Bernie Sanders supporting progressives who may disagree with me on a lot of stuff, we can find common ground on.
There seems to be a dueling pressures here. The questions like you're hearing, why can't you work together? But if either side reaches across the aisle, they get pressure from their own base, their own supporters who criticize them for trying to compromise and work together. Do you feel that pressure?
Definitely. I remember one of the first radio interviews I did when I ran last time, which was my first election. I think the first question I got asked was, you know, compromise has become a dirty word. A lot of people criticized your predecessor for reaching across the aisle. How do you feel about that? And I was kind of shocked and surprised. I mean, you know, the framers and founders created a system where you have to be willing to work together, where no one gets 100% of what they want. And, you know, I'm a conservative and I have conservative views, but there's a lot of issues, too, where the traditional spectrum of left and right, I think, has been turned up and tipped over and it's upside down. And so, you know, I think if you approach this job with the mindset that it's about service, it's about a season of service, not a career, then that pressure you feel goes away, right? You're never going to get it right 100% of the time, but I just try and focus on, you know, how can I improve lives for, you know, hardworking families in Northeast Wisconsin? And, you know, I just try and listen to the bottom-up wisdom that I get from the people in Northeast Wisconsin.
Let's dive into some specific issues that are in the news now that'll still be out there in 2019, I imagine. This week we saw high deficit numbers, a big jump in this year's, the fiscal year's annual deficit. What would you want to do to tackle the annual deficit, the growing federal debt?
Well, at some point, well, it gets to the process issue I mentioned before. We can't continue this process of waiting to the last second and then having gigantic omnibus bills or shutdowns and continuing resolutions. I put forward a proposal saying Congress shouldn't be allowed to go into recess, go on vacation until we actually restored regular order and did budgeting the right way. But then if you look longer term at the budget picture, you know, we're only fighting over 30% of taxpayer money. The rest is just going out the door every single year without any review. And so at some point, we're going to have to get serious about how do we control costs for health care. So what are we doing to shore up Social Security to make sure it's there in 20 years? Because if we do nothing right now, there's going to be a big cut. And so it's going to require men and women of good faith on both sides of the aisle willing to sit down and have an honest debate. We don't have to agree on everything, but in order to get that budget under control, in order to get the deficit and debt under control, that's a conversation we're going to have nationally. And if we just have a bunch of money flooding into all our elections every year, killing people, attacking people for these issues, we're never going to advance the ball down the field, I fear.
One concern that's been raised, particularly by Democrats, was the tax cut bill that passed earlier this year that contributed to a decline in corporate tax revenue, which was part of this increase in the deficit. What do you think about that that tax bill and how it's factored into the deficit?
Well, my understanding is that revenues, at least in the last projected quarter, are up. Certainly, it's my belief that money should be kept in the pockets of American citizens, and the less money that we have being filtered through a series of special interests in Washington, D.C., the more economic growth we're going to have, which is, you know, I refer to that economic pie before. Unless we want to make very brutal decisions between various programs, the best strategy we have going forward is actually to grow the total pie. And so in my opinion, less taxes will help us do that. Now, it's early going right now. This is the first year of it. I also think there's some really innovative stuff in the tax reform proposal, like this concept of opportunity zones, which will allow private capital to flow to distressed areas in Wisconsin, which could help over the long term. But listen, I think it goes back to the overall spending picture of we keep spending more and more money on a variety of things. Some of them aren't working right now, so we need reform. We need transparency. We need to get an understanding of where all the money's going first before we can figure out where to allocate things, and we can stop funding failure, and we can start reinforcing success.
Talking to Representative Mike Gallagher, incumbent Republican in Wisconsin's 8th congressional race. Representative Gallagher, in the news this week, U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia. House Speaker Paul Ryan said if Saudi Arabia is found to have killed missing Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, Congress would look into imposing sanctions on the kingdom. Some of your colleagues, Republican colleagues on the Senate side, being even more emphatic about that idea of sanctions. Is that something you would support doing?
I think it would trigger sanctions under the Magnitsky Act. This is a key moment for Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince. Since taking power, he's done a lot to help modernize his country in the right direction, that is for sure. But we have to be honest and acknowledge that this isn't the first incident that's a cause for concern. Last year, there was a kidnapping of the Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri, to the arrest of women's rights activists, to the Saudi diplomatic spat with Canada. There have been troubling events, and MBS, as he's called, has the potential to be a transformative leader, but he needs to play his hand carefully. And I don't think we help him, and we certainly don't help our moral standing in the world by turning a blind eye to this. Now, I've spent a good deal of my adult life in uniform working in the Middle East with our allies, and I'll be the first to admit that our allies can be problematic at times. They're not perfect. Oftentimes, we don't share their values, and we have to work with some unsavory people to advance broader strategic concerns. But again, the whole point of having close relationships with countries like Saudi Arabia is to be able to nudge them in a better direction. And we can't abide by abhorrent behavior like this if indeed the facts come out that confirm they were behind it.
Turning to trade, the Trump administration has imposed tariffs on Chinese goods, as well as those from Mexico, Canada, and the EU, aluminum and steel foremost among them. What do you think of that strategy on trade?
Well, I think you have to distinguish between two lines of effort, right? There's the so-called Section 301 trade activity, which is getting tough on China. I think by and large, that has been a long overdue step. I think that's a welcome step. But it's really China's non-tariff barriers that are of concern to us. Their applied tariff barriers are higher than ours, but they're still not that high. It's things like intellectual property theft, forced technology transfer, other predatory practices that concern us. But that's been a good story. I've been very critical of the second line of effort, which is the Section 232 tariffs. These are the steel and aluminum tariffs for a couple of reasons. One, if you actually look at the tariffs our allies have, ours are higher if you across the board on average than the EU and Canada. The second is I'm really concerned that our farmers, our manufacturers and farmers in Wisconsin are going to get caught in the crossfire. But the third thing is even if you disagree with me, if you disagree with the notion that tariffs are taxes that pick winners and losers and distort the free market, as I believe, okay, fair enough. But the fact is Congress surrendered this authority to the executive branch as part of a trade liberalizing measure. And I just don't think it holds water for the White House the executive branch to say that we have a national security threat posed by steel and aluminum from other countries. I think that strains the bounds of the statute. And so I think Congress should be in the business of clawing back some of this authority. It's why I introduced legislation that would require Congress to vote on these tariffs. If the White House wants to impose them, it would be retroactive for 2 years. And I have a disagreement with my own party on this. That's fine. The Constitution divides powers for this very purpose. But to me, it's clear under the Constitution that Article 1, the legislative branch, has the authority to regulate commerce with foreign nations.
Let's turn to immigration, a long-running story in Congress without a lot of action from Congress over the years. What would you like to see in 2019?
Well, I voted for a bill that I thought, wasn't perfect, but I would have fixed a lot of the problems. It would have had robust border security and not just a physical barrier or a wall, but also technology, personnel. I was fortunate enough when I was on active duty to spend some time working for the Drug Enforcement Agency, spend some time at the southern border doing counter-narcotics work. The fact is the border is not secure. We have to do it. But the other fact is that it's not just a matter of border security. Most people coming in our country illegally are doing it by overstating their visas. They're not, crossing the Rio Grande in the dead of the night. So it's a more complex issue. But I also think, we have to have a system that's flexible enough where if people want to come here legally, if they want to be part of this awesome American experiment, if they want to pay their taxes and one day become a citizen, we should say amen. That's great. That's part of what's made this country great, particularly at a time when, we're struggling to find workers, the dairy industry, the ag industry is struggling to find workers. So we can do that while at the same time saying we should make it difficult, if not impossible, for people to come here illegally. So I just would encourage my colleagues to kind of maybe depoliticize this a little bit. Let's have a more open and I got to believe we can fix this thing because our immigration system is totally outdated, it's backward, and it's hurting us economically.
Briefly, your thoughts on health care before we let you go, another huge topic.
Yeah, I'll solve it all in 30 seconds. health care is a huge issue. I mean, I probably hear about that besides what I mentioned before, most from people. I have worked across the aisle with a Democrat from Colorado to introduce a bill demanding transparency and pricing from insurance companies and hospitals, because it's my fundamental belief that no matter what you feel about, you know, the broader question of how we finance health insurance, until we as consumers of health care, until we as patients can decipher our hospital bills, until we can understand what we're paying for, we're never going to get the power back where it should be, which is with patients and doctors working together. Instead, that power will continue to shift upwards into big insurance companies, big hospital conglomerates, and that's the complexity that really disadvantages patients. So I think transparency is a key first step. I also would like to see states have a little bit more flexibility to experiment with different delivery systems, because I believe, you know, we're lucky in Wisconsin to have some of the best health outcomes in the country. We want to preserve what's unique about Wisconsin and also have the humility to say that what works for us in Green Bay might be different than what works in Madison or Milwaukee, let alone Manhattan or L.A. And that's the whole genius of the laboratories of democracy. That's what's made our country strong over the years. And so, again, and I know it's a highly politicized issue, but we need people to work together on it.
We'll leave it there. Representative Gallagher, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, sir.
That was Representative Mike Gallagher, a Republican who represents Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. He's running for re-election. Tomorrow at this time, Brown County Assistant District Attorney Beau LeJoyce, the Democratic candidate in that race, will join the show. You can find all of our candidate interviews and learn more about the candidates and races at wisconsinvote.org. If you're a Scrabble player, you'll be happy to know that the word OK, spelled with just two letters, O-N-K, is now officially OK. It was added to the Scrabble dictionary recently along with 300 other new words, including facepalm and sheeple. There are also more than 800 new words added to the Webster Dictionary, reflecting a bit of our modern society. Words like hangry, being hungry and angry, and zoodles, which I think is zucchini noodles, possibly zombie noodles, but I think zucchini, now have a place in the American lexicon. The additions of these words to the dictionary say a lot about how languages adapt over time. Grant Barrett is co-host of the nationwide public radio show Away with Words, which airs Sunday morning at 7 on the Ideas Network. He also compiles the official dictionary of unofficial English, and he's the author of Perfect English Grammar, the indispensable guide to excellent writing and speaking. He's also an officer of the American Dialect Society. Grant, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, how you doing?
Good. Well, before we get into new words, I'm wondering, you know, you do words for a living. Do you play word games, Scrabble, or what have you, or does that feel too much like work?
No, I do it. I play Word Feud, though, which is kind of like a modified version of Scrabble. And a number of years ago, I invited the listeners to the radio show to challenge me. So for 3 years, I played 48 simultaneous games, basically all the time, until I said, oh, I can't do this anymore. So now I just do one or two games at a time.
And I assume you came out with a 48-0 record. You crushed the opposition.
No. I win about two-thirds of my games. There's a lot of really smart people out there.
Especially listening to your show.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly with Scrabble and games like that, there's always this notion of one-upmanship, you know? It's a little bit about the score, but it's a little bit about showing off your vocabulary.
Well, now, speaking of vocabulary, our overall toolkit in the English language keeps changing over time. And I don't know, it's easy to think of a language as a fixed thing, but there's always churn, words coming in and going out of style, right?
Yeah, definitely. The core of it doesn't change much. The core, let's say 20-30% doesn't change much. But certainly around the edges with new technologies and new cultural shifts and trends and fashion and that sort of stuff, that all definitely comes and goes. And it's very attractive to us. We're basically like crows. We like bright, shiny things. And so when a bright, shiny word comes along, we latch onto it, and after a while, we let it go.
A lot of words, and we've talked before about words coming into the dictionary, a lot of times they come out of the world of slang, of kind of unofficial usage. What does it take for the, I guess, lexicographers, the dictionary people, to say, okay, you know what, this slang word is enough of a big deal, we're going to bring it on board?
It's a little different for each dictionary, but in general, a word has to have consistent use over a wide period of time across a wide number of people in a wide number of places. For example, you can't have just one newspaper columnist in Chicago using a word and have it get added to the dictionary. It needs to be used by a variety of people, and the meaning needs to be fixed. Certainly with slang, slang is often really kind of slippery, and words don't necessarily settle into their main final meeting for quite a while. But generally, there are so many new words that lexicographers have more than they can handle. And they are, surprising to a lot of dictionary users, actually rather reluctant to enter new words. You may look at some of these new words and think, oh, well, that's just a passing fad. But it's gone through this whole vetting process, a very careful vetting process, before it got to the page.
Now, are there subgroups of English speakers who are great sources? They're the great biosphere of new language.
Well, they're particularly in groups. So what we have is the larger society as a whole, which we can consider in one culture. But there are stronger identities and stronger subcultures, let's say Black English, for example, or people who are in the military, or firefighters and things like that. And any time you work in close quarters or live in close quarters with people that you have a lot in common with, you tend to develop your own inner language. And then if you're in an environment where those words can leak into the media or into entertainment or music or what have you, then you have a really good chance of your in-group language spreading to the larger community. The greatest example that I know of is RuPaul and all of the drag race stuff that Ru does. That is incredible. They find new words, they generate new words, they popularize them, they just continue to, just the slang machine never stops with RuPaul and all the people involved with his shows.
Has social media changed the spread of new words, sped it up at all?
Well, it has changed the spread. The language was always there, but now there's a better chance that something new is going to catch on. But the other side of that is there's another chance, a quicker chance, a better chance that it will burn out. And this may surprise people, but a lot of times we stop using a word because somebody that we don't really care for started using it, or somebody that we think isn't cool or worthy of our respect started using it, or just because we've heard it too often. So the burnout cycle, the pickup cycle is faster, but the burnout cycle is faster too.
Talking to Grant Barrett from Public Radio's Away with Words. That airs Sunday mornings at 9. I think I said 7 earlier. Sunday mornings at 9 now on the Ideas Network. We're talking about how the English language changes and how new words come along. And Grant, I also want to talk about repurposing old words. There's a process that I've seen called verbing, where people take nouns and turn them into verbs. Impact. Something has an impact, something impacts something. And I thought, Grant, this is a newfangled thing that we're doing. I dug a little deeper. Shakespeare did this a lot. Like compromise, I guess, was just a noun until Shakespeare verbified it.
We noun verbs, we verb nouns, we turn adjectives into nouns. This surprises people. For example, do you eat your greens? Well, what are greens? Greens, that's a noun, a plural noun that came from an adjective. We have a ton of this stuff. Do you remember the old station wagon called a Woody because it have wood side panels? So this is a really standard way to form words in English, changing a part of speech. It's absolutely ordinary, always has been, has always been a part of the language. I'm not sure why it surprises people, but it's there, and we can track it, and Shakespeare wasn't the first and certainly won't be the last.
And people fight back against this. There's a backlash. I think impact is a big one. It's not the only one. Why do we push back on these? Is it right sometimes to push back on these kind of changes?
There's a necessary friction there. I tend not to push back. Anybody who listens to the show know that Martha and I, we have our preferences, but generally we kind of let the language take care of itself, because it's this it's kind of like a public garden where everybody gets a plot and we all cultivate it, and across the whole garden you can see the larger shift. Oh, everyone's doing zucchini this year. We're all doing zucchini. I think when we push back against language, it's usually because we haven't stopped to think very hard about who's doing it, why they're doing it, how often they're doing it, who else is doing it, what it means. Like, if you start to gather the data and think about it like a field lexicographer, somebody out there with a notebook and a tape recorder trying to record the language, you'll begin to see patterns, and you'll begin to recognize, oh, it's not just this one word. This is how it's done across this whole category of language. This is ordinary, and I've just happened to find this new example.
Can I make a request, Grant, for you and your dictionary-type cronies? Now, we've got this gap in the English language. I think it's, what is it, the second person plural, where if I say you to one person, I say you to multiple people. Sometimes you know what I'm talking about. You all, y'all, yous, all y'all. Those are great substitutes. Can we pick one of those and just make it part of the language already?
It's not a gap. We have one already. We just decided we don't like it because it also means the singular. Yeah. You is also plural. What we're seeing now is kind of a shakeout where it looks like, for example, y'all is becoming more common. It is bleeding outside of the American South. Yens and yuns and Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania and places like throughout Pennsylvania is growing a little bit. So people see this need. But the big winner, and this is going to concern some people, is you guys. You guys, at least in North America, North American English tends to be the most favored third-person plural.
Interesting. We're talking with Grant Barrett, co-host of Away with Words. He's with us to talk about how new words enter the English language, whether you want them or not, and maybe even make their way into your Scrabble dictionary and games. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a word you think should be added to the dictionary, Scrabble or otherwise? Do you have questions about language and new words for Grant? Is there a new word or the usage of a word that you want to fight against? If it's this garden of language, it's the creeping Charlie for you. You want to root it out. Call and tell us about that. And do you have a preference? You all, y'all, you guys? Yen, I'm not as familiar with that. That's a Pennsylvania thing. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation with Grant and maybe with you coming up on Central Time. Right now, we continue our conversation about how new words get created and become commonplace in our day-to-day language, in some cases even find their way into a dictionary. Grant Barrett is with us, co-host of the public radio show Away with Words. You can hear him and Martha Barnett here on the Ideas Network Sunday mornings at 9. He's with us to talk about how new words get created. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you picked up on a new word lately? Where did it come from? Is there a word that you use in your maybe line of work, in your social group, that you think could catch on above and beyond your local community? Is there a word you wish you could push back on, or a word that impacts you in a bad way? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Go to your calls now. Eric is with us in Madison. Eric, hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Eric?
Well, you know, I love how the English language, you know, is continuing to evolve. But, you know, I keep going back to three really big points that I keep getting sucked into little debates about. And one's based off of Strunk and White's Elements of Style. The other is Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. And then that would naturally lead to the Oxford comma. And so how does that get all fleshed out? How does that relate to how this language evolution tends to continue?
All right. Thanks for the call, Eric. Grant, you can sum up the Oxford comma probably better and more concisely than I can.
So if you have three items in a row, you will do apples, commas, bananas, commas, and oranges, right? However, some people, some style guides say that you should not put the comma before the conjunction. And that's often called the Oxford comma. I learned it as a Harvard comma like 40 years ago. But it's a style choice. It's not really, it's one of these things we love to argue about, even though it's not altogether that important. The main thing is, once your organization decides to use the comma, just go ahead and keep using it.
All right. Just usage. I'm a fan. I like it. Do you personally,
I've heard
Grant?
It well.
All right.
I do, yeah. Although I came of age with the AP style as a cub journalist and learned not to use it, but I've since put it back in because it adds clarity.
We are on the same side. Thanks for that call. We'll go to Stacy in St. Croix Beach, Minnesota. Stacy, hi.
Hi.
What word did you want to bring up?
The use of the word on, or the words on accident. I think that it's a combination of something that was an accident, on purpose, instead of using by accident. And it honestly drives me nuts. And I'd like to get your feedback on the proper or improper usage of the words on accident.
Stacey, thanks for the call. And I might just say, like, accidentally, instead of using any preposition at all. Grant, your thoughts.
On purpose is definitely probably the origin of people saying on accident rather than by accident. There is an age division here. It's roughly, if you're in your mid-30s or below, you probably say on accident. And roughly, if you're above your mid-30s, you probably say by accident.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. Becky is with us now in Ladysmith. Becky, thanks for calling. What did you want to bring up?
Hi, yes. I'd like to bring up the new word, the new definition of the word gay. And I have nothing against the population it represents, but gay used to mean a fun time, a fun gay time. And it's just a shame, I think, that now nobody says it's a gay old time anymore. I think people would look at me funny if I ever said that to someone. And I just wanted your thoughts of that word and why it was picked. And not a different word was picked. It was a shame that we lost the meaning of gay.
Becky, thanks for the call. Grant?
Well, gay started switching around the 1920s, if you can believe it. And for decades, the two uses overlapped, where gay meaning fine or fantastic or having a good time, overlapping with gay meaning homosexual. And then by the 1960s, the old-fashioned, the idea of gay meaning fun and great and good and had seemed old-fashioned, and the new sense kind of won out. And then, of course, we have an even more modern use of gay, which is derogatory use of gay to describe something as bad, and that's the one that is usually frowned upon and not something I would recommend that anyone use.
Thanks for the call. Kurt is with us now in Milwaukee. Kurt, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. I understand you have a new word for us.
Well, I would like to see a new word instituted. My stepdaughter came up with it about 30 years ago, defining adhesive quality. The term she used was gription.
I
just kind of liked it. You knew immediately what she was talking about when she used that word.
And does this come up a lot in your life, the need for that word to describe adhesive properties?
Not a lot, but it did at that point in time.
Kurt, thank you so much. It makes intuitive sense. I think if somebody said it even without the setup, Grant, I would have gotten it.
Yeah, it's actually in Wiktionary, if you want to go to look in Wiktionary. It's there. Somebody else had the idea, too, and added it.
Maybe it was your daughter, Kurt. Thanks a lot for sharing. Gription. I love it. We'll go next to Ann in Madison. Ann, hi.
Hi, and hi, Grant. Love your show. So I will see a word that I've never seen before. I don't know what it means. And I look it up and I learn it. And then all of a sudden I see it everywhere. Like the word preternatural, right?
Yeah.
Preternatural. I saw it in an email recently, and I thought it was a typo, And I looked it up, and it was a real word. And I've seen it twice since then.
Funny. Anne, thanks a lot. It's almost preternatural that you keep seeing it. This is a common experience. Once we're watching for that new word, we spot it everywhere, Grant?
Yeah, there's a couple different names for it. One of them is called the recency illusion, the illusion that something is more recent than it actually is. The other one is called the Bader-Meinhof syndrome, which was coined some decades ago by somebody who realized the first time they saw Bader-Meinhof, they kept seeing it everywhere, only to realize everyone else had been talking about it for a very long time. They just simply hadn't noticed it. So it's definitely, we get emails about this on the show all the time. People have this happen to them very frequently. And it's because we're kind of cued to see a thing. We become more aware of a thing once we first encountered it.
Thanks for the call. And Grant, thanks. It's always fun to talk to you. We'll listen for you on Sunday.
Thank you.
That's Grant Barrett, co-host of the nationwide public radio show Away With Words, compiler of the official Dictionary of Unofficial English, and author of Perfect English Grammar. He joined us today to talk about the hundreds of new words added to the Scrabble dictionary and how new words enter the language. You can catch Grant Barrett Sunday mornings at 9 on Away With Words on the Ideas Network. The race for governor this year has provided a clear contrast between Republican Scott Walker and Democratic challenger Tony Evers when it comes to how Wisconsin runs its prisons. As Rich Kramer reports, Evers is talking more openly than any candidate in years about reducing the state's prison population.
During the last couple general elections for governor, Walker's Democratic challengers ran mostly unopposed in their primaries. Tony Evers didn't have that luxury. He faced 9 Democratic opponents, and liberal groups worked hard to push the entire field to the left. When it came to prisons, the other Democrats pledged to reduce Wisconsin's prison population by more than half. At their first televised debate, Evers was asked by a moderator if he too supported the goal.
Do you support that original goal, and how would you balance reducing the prison population and protecting
public safety? Absolutely, and that's a goal that's worth accomplishing.
Evers won the primary convincingly, but Republicans seized on his prison comments. Soon after, Governor Scott Walker went on the attack.
Now, Evers wants to cut Wisconsin's prison population in half. A dangerous plan that today would mean releasing thousands of violent criminals back into our communities.
When it comes to prison policy, Walker couldn't be any more different than Evers. For decades, he's pushed for longer sentences for offenders, not shorter. When he was a state representative in the 1990s, Walker was a lead proponent of truth in sentencing laws, which eliminated parole and has led to more offenders being locked up for rule violations while on probation. Walker says his push for truth in sentencing went back to a conversation with an assault victim who saw her attacker paroled before serving a full sentence.
She deserved to know if she was going to go face down the perpetrator of that crime, exactly how much time he was going to serve in prison. And under the old system, he got out early.
But even people who joined Walker in the 90s have had a change of heart. Former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson approved the construction of 12 new prisons in Wisconsin at a time when the prison population tripled. Today, he says he regrets that.
Well, I think I built too many prisons when I was governor, and I've apologized for that.
Thompson is now calling for more treatment, diversion, and job training programs to reduce the prison population and address a shortage of skilled workers. Prison spending has also become a rallying cry for advocates. Wisconsin has more than 23,500 inmates in prisons at a cost of $2.5 billion in the current state budget. Advocates often compare that to Minnesota's prison system, which houses 9,000 inmates at less than half of what Wisconsin spends. Gina Evans is the Community Outreach Director for Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, which offers faith-based treatment and counseling. She says a major difference between the two states is that in Minnesota, any resident can get subsidized alcohol and drug treatment if they ask for it.
Evidence shows that if we can get people through treatment in the community to begin that road to recovery in the community, that their chances of attaining long-term sobriety and jobs and education go up exponentially.
These are the types of programs Evers has talked about on this campaign, even after his primary win. Last month, he held an event with former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder that focused on keeping nonviolent offenders out of prison and reducing Wisconsin's racial disparities within its criminal justice system.
We have to learn from other states that have talked about the issues of making sure that we not only have drug courts, but we have also diversion and treatment programs so that we can actually bring people back into society and become contributing members of society.
Evers' promise to cut the prison population is hardly central to his campaign, and for the time being, Walker has moved on to other issues too. But neither candidate has backed down from their positions, giving voters two distinctly different paths for how Wisconsin could run its prisons for years to come. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can check out more stories related to the election at wisconsinvote.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there's a federal deficit, there's a Social Security system. Do they have anything to do with each other? An expert on the federal budget helps us make sense of it all. And on Food Friday, it's the most wonderful time of the year, which means winter squash season. Our own Lori Skelton has some great squash recipes. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.